I'm going to talk about some work done with my various collaborators. Okay. Let me just first say that the last time I was here was on this site was a long time ago. I'm not sure if everyone knows the geographical history. This site used to be an arena that was condemned and had an inflatable bubble roof put on top, and finally was torn down, and I believe now is the site of a perimeter.
And this is you?
And this is me. So this is the olden days before we wore helmets.
Not a physics question, but did they just move the arena? Because of course there's the thing now, there's a big arena down there, right, just across the street.
If it has a roof, then they either put a new roof on.
It's not an arena, it's the rec center, right, but it's sort of...
I've told you as much as I know. Okay. Maybe I'll just advance here. I got here, but
there's more to the top than the history.
I think it's the computer.
Yeah. So
where?
Is it? Okay. So I'll talk about three things. Some formalism in heavy particle effective theories, so motivated by the need to describe standard model systems at high orders in the 1 over m expansion, and by the need to say things about beyond standard model systems where we may not know the UV completion, but where we can use a heavy particle expansion to isolate universal features. Motivated by that, there is a piece of formalism that was missing in the heavy particle literature, namely how to enforce Lorentz invariance on a non-relativistic Lagrangian at arbitrary order. And I'll give a pedestrian description of what we found. Okay, and I should be able to go back here. Okay. What if I just remove this? Does that... Okay, so, all right, so this these are my the various people I've worked with or who've done the work. Johannes Heinonen, Mikhail Salon, a student at Chicago. Johannes is now at Ziegen. Gil Paz, now faculty at Wayne State, and Gabriel Lee, also a student at Chicago. So this is where we'll get eventually. Description of the proton radius and the status of proton structure corrections in that system, and computation of WIMP nucleon scattering for simple neutralino-like systems in the heavy particle limit. Okay, Lorentz invariance in heavy particle theories. In answer to the question, what is a chiral Lagrangian, we can say it's a nonlinear realization of chiral symmetries on a system of pions. In the same sense, we can answer the question, what is a heavy particle Lagrangian, by saying it's a nonlinear representation of Lorentz symmetries on a non-relativistic field. A more difficult and as yet not fully answered question is, what is soft collinear effective theory? So I'll restrict attention to the heavy particle framework. And we need some information about induced representations and their implementation in effective field theories. And we find an interesting disagreement with standard ansatz throughout the heavy particle literature, going to an order that was required by the proton radius analysis. Okay, so then I'll, time permitting, talk about two applications. The first of which is the description of TEV scale, or large mass dark matter, in which the masses of the weak vector bosons W and Z are small compared to the dark matter mass, and we can apply a heavy particle description. This both encapsulates the universal features independent of the UV completion, and also simplifies certain two-loop integrals that appear at leading order in the perturbative expansion. And I'll also say a few words about proton structure in atomic bound states, or more generally nuclear structure in atomic bound states, and develop some of the modern analysis in the framework of NRQED. This allows us to identify some conflicting definitions in the charge radius that led to some small double counting issues in muonic hydrogen, and isolate and analyze an as yet poorly constrained contact interaction representing two photon exchange. Okay, effective field theory and induced representations. Okay, so some textbook analysis of Lorentz invariants in quantum field theory. We have a finite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group. We can implement Lorentz transformations on fields by translating the coordinate and rearranging indices according to that representation. We can build a Lorentz scalar Lagrangian and prove straightforwardly that the resulting S matrix is Lorentz invariant. And in detail, we can construct conserved charges for each of the space-time translations represented by the stress-energy tensor. And we can construct conserved and symmetric currents for each of the homogeneous Lorentz transformations. And we can build those from the we can construct a conserved symmetric stress energy tensor, and using that we can construct the generators for each of the homogeneous Lorentz transformations. Hamiltonian angular momentum, momentum and boost generators. In a full interacting theory, the definition of those generators in terms of the stress energy tensor can be shown, for example, in canonical quantization to imply the commutation relations for the Poincaré algebra. And if we can show that each of the free generators commutes with the scattering matrix, then we can establish Lorentz invariants for scattering states. Or in other words, Lorentz invariants of the S matrix. So we'll assume, as in all reasonable effective or reasonable field theories that we consider, that the free and interacting momentum and angular momentum expressed in terms of canonical coordinates are identical, and that we have shown, for example, by the relativistic construction, that the following commutation relation is true. Then we have this identity as well as this identity, from which follows the non-trivial commutation relation that the commutator of the free boost and the scattering matrix vanishes. And that follows from an additional smoothness assumption that, roughly speaking, follows from the existence of the S matrix. Okay, so that's finite dimensional representations of the Lorentz group. Is this all we need? So from my favorite textbook, there is the following statement. There is no advantage in considering transformation laws more general than 3.8. However, Many particles, like a composite proton, have only a heavy particle description. There's no extension of the non-relativistic proton field into a relativistic theory involving the proton as an elementary particle. In other systems, we don't know the UV completion for. And for such systems, our only choice is a heavy particle framework in which we must use induced representations. Okay, so how does Lorentz invariance work for these systems? There are three classes of induced representations based on the choice of invariant vector. So we first find either a time-like vector v mu, a light-like vector n mu, or a space-like vector s mu. We consider the little group associated with that invariant vector defined as the subgroup of Lorentz transformations that leave that vector invariant. And if we can find a mapping of the full Lorentz group into the little group and no representations of the little group, then we find induced representations for the full Lorentz group. Okay, and these representations are used to enforce or to represent Lorentz on physical states. We want to use them to let Lorentz act on fields. Okay, so the construction is obtained as follows. For an arbitrary Lorentz transformation lambda, we can define a matrix, call it L of P, for each P such that L of P acting on the default reference vector gives us P. And then we construct the mapping of lambda into the little group. Lambda goes to W of lambda by constructing L inverse evaluated at lambda P times the matrix lambda times L of P. And we can see that L of P acting on V gives us P. Lambda acting on P gives us lambda P. And L inverse of lambda P acting on lambda P gives us back V. So W takes V to V. In other words, it's an element of the little group. It's a rotation. We know how to represent rotations, and therefore we know how to represent Lorentz by first mapping Lorentz into rotations and choosing a certain spin representation of the rotation group. Okay, so there's a continuous variable P, and so these representations are infinite dimensional. And we can run through the demonstration of Lorentz invariance with such fields by building an effective Lagrangian transforming under an induced representation in a free theory, just partial derivatives as opposed to covariant derivatives. We can find the infinitesimal generators acting on the fields. These fields satisfy the Poincaré algebra when acting on fields satisfying equations of motion. And we can show correspondingly that such a free theory has a Lorentz invariant S matrix. Okay, the interacting theory, the crucial point we need to show is this commutation relation. By the construction of the boost generator, we can actually show that the explicit time dependence is linearly proportional to time. And since by construction we enforce invariance under boost generators, the following equation is true, implying this commutation relation. And since we've already demonstrated Lorentz invariance for the non-interacting theory, the same argument is used to show the commutation relations of the free boost generator with a scattering matrix, and we've built a Lorentz invariant theory. Okay, this all assumes that we can find a Lagrangian that isn't variant under the assumed rotation and boost generators. And so I'll say a few words about how we do that. Okay, so we needed to first enforce invariance under rotations. This is the subset of lambda such that W of lambda is equal to lambda. And we can choose the fields in a Lagrangian to transform. In the usual way under rotations, the induced representation is the same as the finite dimensional representation of rotations. Since we also have that lambda V is equal to V, all of our lambdas carry through the Lagrangian, and the usual law of just contracting mu's with mu's gives us a Lorentz scalar Lagrangian and is invariant under little group elements. We also have to enforce invariance under boosts. So these are the subset of Lorentz transformations that do not satisfy lambda V is equal to V, but rather infinitesimally, let's call it lambda V is V plus Q. And we've defined how fields transform as an induced representation. And this is the analog of so-called reparameterization invariance in heavy particle theories. We're not reparameterizing anything, if you like. It's a passive versus an active description. We're not shifting V mu, but simply considering Lorentz transformation lambda that does shift V. Whereas reparameterization invariance takes an opposing point of view where we view V as shifting to a V prime. It's just a passive versus an active approach. We can extend to arbitrary spin, of course, since we know all the representations of the rotation group. And we can see that inconsistencies arise at order 1 over m to the fourth in the canonical ansatz used for reparameterization invariance. I'll give you an idea of how that argument goes. There's an interplay of Lorentz and gauge symmetry that only appears at order 1 over m to the fourth, analogous to the conflict of gauge and chiral symmetry that appears at four derivative order in a chiral Lagrangian. Okay, so this is just a pedestrian solution that allows us to construct a Lorentz invariant Lagrangian, enforcing invariance under induced representations of boosts. If we can solve the following equation given by the top line, and if we define a capital psi which is equal to this gamma times our original psi, the little psi which transforms an induced representation, then our capital psi transforms just with a phase. And the solution for such a gamma translates into a solution of this so-called invariance equation. And now we can just turn the crank and find the solution to that invariance equation, working to first order in the infinitesimal Q. If I define the expansion of the little group element as a series in Xi, and I define the solution gamma as a series gamma I, then using that the variation of gamma has two terms given by dependence on d mu and dependence on v mu, the solution to the equation is represented by the following partial differential equation. And this is an analog of grad phi equals E for a electrodynamics problem.
that you want psi to transform just with a phase under under the Lorentz transformation, the shift.
Yes. Under a Lorentz transformation, that shifts v. Yes. So a gamma that satisfies this necessarily satisfies, if and only necessarily satisfies this equation, and vice versa. So I want to.
So you have three. You have no equation except for the definition involving the little sign.
Okay. So let me first say that this should be a little sign notationally up here.
So it's a little sign transforms with the non-trivial Auger factor. And then you want to try to define this lambda maps it onto a sign, a big sign.
Right. So apart from this phase factor, which you can identify as extracting the rest mass of a particle, I basically want to find an invariant field.
Right.
Yes, so it's the analog of saying I want to build a chiral matrix field that transforms in a nice way under a chiral rotation so that I can build trivial Lagrangians out of this field as opposed to trying to patch together pion fields at higher orders in derivatives.
And under rotations, then big psi would transform the same way as little psi, because lambda is
The same as little psi. Okay. So gamma is trivial for rotations. Or the let's look at that.
Oh, I guess you've chosen your W such that W of lambda rotation is just lambda, right? And so that Q equals zero.
So for rotations, yes, so W is lambda, lambda inverse lambda is one, and Q is zero. And we've already made the Lagrangian invariant under rotations. And I hope that answers the question. Okay, so we're just left with Boos, and we can build a Lagrangian invariant under Boos out of this field if we can satisfy this equation. And now we just want to find a systematic solution to that equation. And so there's a series of steps back and forth to create this solution. We can build a solution order by order if we can solve this equation iteratively. We define this quantity y in terms of the previous order solutions gamma, and in terms of x, which is just given to us, defined by the induced representation. And the solution to that equation is given by the top line, but it's a solution if and only if we have this constraint on y. That constraint on y, from its definition, is equivalent to this constraint on x. And we can solve that constraint, provided that the thing I'm calling z here satisfies this consistency condition, which is the analog of del dot b vanishing if we solve the equation curl a equals b.
I'm getting confused with what x, y, z represent. So you expand gamma, you show that gamma is a solution if it can be written as this expansion. And what is y in this expansion? Is anything that satisfies?
No, sorry. Y is what I'm introducing y here. So gamma 0, So I first solve for gamma zero. It turns out to be trivial. And once I know gamma zero, I can construct y1 by adding up all of these terms. And given y1, I can construct my solution gamma zero. Gamma 1, and now given gamma 1, I can construct the next order y2 and go back and construct my gamma 2 and so on. However, my solution for gamma in terms of these y's is valid only if this constraint equation is satisfied, and now I have to solve that equation, that constraint equation, order by order as well. And the solution of that constraint equation is equivalent to this constraint equation, where I'm introducing now this z, and there's finally a consistency condition on z such that I can solve this equation. And we can show inductively that there is a solution order by order, and it's given by these expressions. So I'll just give a...
This is first non-trivial for n equals zn to z1, yes?
So gamma starts as 1.
Oh, okay.
So gamma 1 is the first non-trivial one. So I refer you to the appendix of our paper where all of the x, y's, and z's are worked out in detail, and it's probably, you know, it's straightforward to just solve order by order, and it's a straightforward inductive argument to show that the solution does exist, and the solution can be taken in this form. If we want x to reduce down to a particular form when we turn off gauge couplings, then we can find a solution that does that. And it is some covariantization of the free x plus correction terms. And the point of disagreement with naive reparametrization invariance is that simply taking partial derivatives to covariant derivatives doesn't in general give a solution. And the deviation appears first at a certain order. Okay, so this is how it appears, order by order, gamma 1, 1/2 I d perp slash, gamma 2 and gamma 3 and so on, have certain forms. And there is a deviation between that solution and a naive solution, which just takes partial derivatives and promotes them to covariant derivatives. That deviation first appears at order 1 over m cubed. And we can see that there are certain terms that are not the covariantization of any theory with g equals to 0. There are some other terms that can be gotten rid of by field redefinition, but these cannot, and they lead to a difference in physical predictions. All right, so just in detail, for a heavy fermion, we can choose a two-component Weyl spinner, or we can choose equivalently a Dirac spinner with a constraint equation, b slash psi equals psi. If we extract the rest mass by a phase redefinition, we'll end up with this field psi prime, and we enforce invariance under rotations just by using the spin half representation of rotations. And we enforce invariance under boosts by first mapping into the group of rotations and applying the induced representation element for that rotation. All right, so at the end of the day, we can write down the most general NRQED, for example, an abelian gauge field for a spin half fermion, and we can write down the most general parity in time reversal invariant Lagrangian through order 1 over m to the fourth. The induced representation looks like this if we expand it out in powers 1 over m. Transformation of derivatives and gauge fields is as usual. And if we turn the crank, either by solving this invariance equation and writing invariant operators and then comparing it to that form of the Lagrangian, or by doing a more pedestrian approach by just explicitly working out the variation, then we find this set of non-renormalization theorems. A subset of these are required in the muonic hydrogen analysis and was what motivated, in part, investigating reparameterization invariance at this order and the deviation from naive reparameterization invariance affects this operator, which is an interaction of the pointing vector with the particle's momentum. All right, so that's formalism. And I'll say a few words about two applications, one of which is dark matter, and the other is proton structure in atomic hydrogen. Okay, so in analogy to heavy quark effective theory, or heavy electron effective theory, NRQED, we can build a heavy WIMP effective theory. For example, if we take a WENO-like LSP, or a weakly interacting stable pion coupled to SU2, or other possible candidates, if we simply state that its mass is large compared to electric scale particles, and that it is a certain representation, for example, a triplet of SU2, then we can compute properties such as its scattering cross-section on nucleons and nuclei. So the two aspects of the effective theory are to be independent of the UV completion and to simplify and actually enable a first computation of a class of two-loop diagrams that appear at leading order when matching onto the effective description at low energy. Okay, so there are quark operators and gluon operators, and we can write down a leading expansion onto a complete basis of operators with controlled corrections of order MW over M dark matter, lambda QCD over charm mass, and B quark mass over MW.
Sorry, Richard, I'm not sure. So there is some assumption that I'm making here that I'm not sure I'm understanding. I could also have just a single Z exchange in principle, and that won't be described by this sort of 4-point interaction.
I'm assuming a self-conjugate dark matter particle. For example, the neutral component of a scalar or Majorana triplet.
So in that line you drew, the double line you drew for the WIMP, the thing that is in the loop is actually some excited state of the WIMP or some other state.
So that would be the charged partner of the of the neutral.
So you're assuming there's some mass split between the two line outside and the line inside.
Yes, and you can actually calculate that mass splitting in the same 1 over m limit, but it's small for the purposes of this this matching calculation. Okay, so this is a multi-scale problem, and it's important to pull apart the different scales. For example, to resum QCD logarithms in order to match onto a low energy description, three flavor, perhaps four flavor QCD, where we can evaluate nucleon matrix elements. And to get down to such low scales, we have to be careful with large logarithms in QCD perturbation theory. And we can do that by constructing a sequence of effective theories, integrating out the dark matter large mass scale, the electroweak scale particle masses, heavy particle masses, and finally arriving at the scale of the strong interactions. And if we like, we can build an effective description to describe the nuclear physics as well.
Big Q means the electric charge, electron charge.
Big. Ah, very good. Yes, so I'm taking just the lightest electrically neutral particle, which is the WIMP of interest, and assuming that the other guys just are not relevant to the processes I'm interested in. Okay, so we can turn the crank with our heavy particle formalism for the leading order description here. The higher order corrections are not relevant other than to notice that they all are higher order corrections. This is for the representation of a real scalar. Lorentz invariance fixes all coefficients in this expansion apart from a radius operator, CD, which is also equal to CM, and various polarizabilities. A simple statement that should be well known is that such a heavy gauge scalar is determined by two numbers plus polarizabilities. Interactions with standard model particles. The essential point here, in addition to some non-trivial Lorentz invariance relations, everything is suppressed by 1 over m, the leading term given by a Higgs-Higgs interaction. Okay, and then the lower energy theory that will eventually match onto is constructed in a similar way. There's a reality constraint forbidding CD, the radius term, and there's a basis of operators. There are five active quarks below the top quark mass. For each of those quarks, there's a spin zero and a spin two operator, or a scalar and a tensor operator, and there's also a scalar and a tensor gluon operator. So 12 coefficients in total. And if we're completely agnostic, it's simply said that our particle was represented by a self-conjugate thing at higher scales, then we could look at those 12 operator coefficients and put constraints on them and so on. So we'll actually look at a computation in a pure state case for a pure electric triplet, for example, that gives you a zero parameter representation of these coefficients. Or certain mixed cases that give a two-parameter representation of those coefficients. Okay, so this is just saying that we can compute the mass shift of the charge relative to neutral components, for example, in a isospin J, integer isospin J representation of SU2, just working out the induced residual mass in the heavy particle framework shows this universal mass splitting for a triplet. It gives about 170 MeV for the charge relative to neutral plus order 1 over m corrections. So if you were able to produce these guys at colliders, there's the well-known effect that they would have a macroscopic decay length, restricted phase space for the decay. Okay, so just some overview of the matching calculations. Matching onto quark operators, this is the full theory, the heavy WIMP effective theory, matching onto the theory where electroweak scale particles are integrated out. There are gluon operators, again, the full theory simplified by the heavy particle Feynman rules, matching onto the effective theory where we integrate out the weak scale particles.
That's the question we asked before. So I agree that when the thing that you're exchanging are zero or something like that, then you integrate them out. But suppose what you're exchanging is the photon actually, or some photon prime, right?
You can assume that, but that's a different assumption than I'm making.
Right. So that's the thing I think that I was missing. So you're assuming that all the things that get exchanged are all heavy particles.
Right, because this is electrically neutral, and there is no photon prime.
No, that's not necessarily true, right? If you have, if the dark matter is a Wino, the charged states of the Wino are very degenerate in mass. So in the annihilation, they will matter because you can annihilate it first as a W, but then you can have a ladder of photons.
Annihilation is a very different problem, and I'm looking at scattering.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this fine one is
Yes, so in the same way that, you know, if you build HQET to describe B meson decays, it's not going to tell you much about B,
B
bar annihilation.
The problem where a photon actually does appear is if the dark matter has a magnetic dipole on, with a photon. So then you can have this sort of diagram where you have two exchanges of photon. I'm not trying to derail the discussion. I'm just trying to
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. So I'm staying my assumptions,
yes.
And I'm using the separation in scales and working at leading order in 1/m, in which case this is the interaction of standard model gauge fields with the dark matter, and that's the only interaction of the standard model with the dark matter. Okay, so I mean, there are some simplifications that come as expected from using the heavy particle description. For example, electric gauge invariance is immediate. If we look at the uncrossed and the crossed diagrams here, the gauge variation is proportional to a term, which, when multiplying those propagators, gives a manifestly vanishing contribution. In order to evaluate these two-loop diagrams, it's convenient to use Fock-Schwinger gauge in order to derive operators immediately without taking gluon matrix elements. Okay, so having matched onto the theory below the scale of the electroweak particles, we can solve the normalization group equations, running down to the B quark mass, at which point we'll integrate out the B quark, and so on down to the three-flavor QCD theory. The spin zero renormalization group equations are well known because the operators appear in the Lagrangian, hence the anomalous dimensions are related to the beta function in the mass anomalous dimension of QCD. Spin two anomalous dimensions are similarly familiar from the analysis of parton distribution functions. Okay, so integrating out heavy quarks, threshold matching at each of the heavy quark mass thresholds.
So yes? A technical comment, though. I don't think it matters because I don't think a two-loop would ever matter during any calculation.
Disagree.
Okay, so that then what Mina is saying is right, that you could have a diagram where you have a W exchange, you excite to the charge state, then you have a photon exchange with the photon, and then another W exchange bringing you back to the neutral component.
But that's a higher order in electroweak.
There's another additional loop of electroweak. That's true. It's not strong coupling. You're just adding loops of strong coupling. So it's a two-loop diagram, but it's a strong loop, right?
So I'm going to work at first order in electroweak couplings, it will be,
okay.
And at first order in electroweak couplings for each of the 12 possible operators, I'm going to compute the leading contribution at whatever order in QCD coupling that turns out to be. And perhaps surprisingly, these two-loop diagrams, nothing is surprising once you know the answer, but because of the large gluon matrix helmet and the proton,
yeah,
those two-loop diagrams are very relevant. Okay, so the heavy quark threshold matching is well known. To a certain order, it actually turns out that there are some interesting corrections at the charm mass that for which it would be useful to know results at higher order. So we run down to B, threshold matching, run down to C, and finally run down further if we like to match onto a three-flavor QCD theory where lattice or other methods can be used to evaluate matrix elements. Okay, so for spin zero, we can access the gluon matrix element by making use of the decomposition of the matrix element of the stress energy tensor in QCD. Okay, so the nucleon mass has various contributions, and therefore the gluon matrix element is related to the sum over scalar matrix elements of the quarks inside the nucleon. Higher order corrections in this equation, which is often used in dark matter analyses, is those corrections can turn out to be numerically relevant. And part of the story is that lattice QCD has made advances to determine the strange quark content of the nucleon with relatively good precision recently. Okay, spin two, relevant matrix elements are related to certain moments of parton distribution functions. We can evaluate these either at a high scale or a low scale and obtain the neutron matrix elements using approximate isospin symmetry. Okay, so this is the resulting prediction for a heavy self-conjugate electroweak triplet particle to scatter from a nucleon, looking at the usual numerical benchmark of low velocity spin-independent cross-section on an isolated nucleon. Okay, so this is a isotriplet of electroweak SU2. The blue is a Higgsino-like particle. The Higgs mass, about 126, and therefore the triplet cross-section in this limit is of order 10 to the minus 47 centimeters squared, taking into account the standard model uncertainties and the perturbative QCD uncertainty.
For the double, there's some approximate translation?
Yeah, so both for the triplet and the doublet, there's a cancellation, and that is coming from the fact that all of the scalar amplitudes are one sign and all of the tensor amplitudes are another sign. If one were to, instead of the lattice values for the scalar matrix elements, use canonical values from SU3 chiral perturbation theory, you see a similar dip structure for the triplet case. I would say that the lattice has superseded those values. But this is the separate amplitudes and a normalization that is not important. But the important point is that the contributions of the spin two contributions of up, down, gluon, and strange, those contributions in the spin two channel are one sign, and the contributions of the glue, strange, and up and down are an opposite sign in the spin zero channel. And this is plotted now as a function of the strange quark scalar matrix element. Lattice QCD puts it roughly in this band, and the older variance spectroscopy value was in this wide band. So that's the source of the cancellation. This is just illustrating the situation from lattice QCD. From variance spectroscopy, one has to arrive at the strange quark scalar matrix element as a difference of two rather large quantities, whereas the lattice just accesses it directly, and the relative size of the uncertainty is not large, but it's simply shown that it's relatively small as opposed to very large. There's some dependence on the charm scalar matrix element as well. And finally, We can also analyze mixed states. Okay, so it's very hard to put a measure on UV completion space. One can argue that when you're dealing with particles that are now large in mass compared to electroweak scale particles, that finding one multiplet and then another multiplet within the order MW of the first multiplet is in some sense a fine-tuning. And I'm not going to try to define fine-tuning, but at least it is generic that the second multiplet is not within order MW of the first, in which case pure states are generic. Okay. But extending to two mixed states, where the second is assumed to be within order 1 times MW of the first, we have to introduce a residual mass to represent that mass splitting, and now there are direct interactions with the Higgs field. For example, mediating interactions between a beano and a Higgsino, or a weano and a Higgsino. And this is just the analogous result for the cross-section in a beano-Higgsino system, or any UV completion with those quantum numbers, a singlet and a doublet.
What's the x-axis?
And now, I'm sorry, I've erased the x-axis here. The x-axis is the same in this plot, which is a triplet-doublet combination. And this is the mass difference of the two particles, of the two multiplets, measured in units of MW times a constant. And so when that mass splitting is large compared to MW, you get a pure doublet, which we saw was very small cross-section, or in the opposite direction, a pure triplet. And when it's order one, there is an interplay of the Higgs exchange contribution with the loop-induced contributions. Okay, so pure states are recovered in the appropriate limits, and we've reduced the ten-parameter space of coefficients, 5 quarks plus 1 gluon. 12-parameter space of coefficients reduced to 2 parameters. And sorry, the resonance structure. So this is with a somewhat large value, or at least a moderate value of the coupling to the Higgs field, in which tree-level Higgs exchange dominates the cross-section. And so once the mass splitting becomes large, that the amplitudes are suppressed by the mass splitting. Otherwise, if you have almost degenerate states, then there isn't that mass suppression. Okay, so that's...
So how does this compare to the previous determinations of the velocity cross sections by limits of the group?
I'm not aware of work by that group in this regime. There have been some computations of, or
well,
estimates.
They've looked at the regulation cross sections for Winos and Xenos and all those stuff.
But I believe you'll find that all of those are really just looking at the direct Higgs exchange, ignoring the loop induced contributions. Let me not comment on results I am not aware of, but the typical situation is that there's a lot going on at the electroweak scale.
Right.
And if you have, you know, well, and when there, when there's a lot going on, you're going to have these tree-level exchanges.
Right.
And it is only recently that things have been pushed higher, and hence these loop-induced contributions have become more relevant. And we can talk in detail about where some calculations of those loop-induced contributions are either wrong or lacking. But I think that's better offline. Okay, so I think I should be brief here in the final part, but one of the other motivations for looking at this formalism was to describe proton structure in atoms. And I know that some or all of you are familiar with the proton radius puzzle. This is one slightly outdated table of values for the proton radius from electron scattering, old values and more recent values in the red versus the co-data summary in the green, induced inferred from electronic hydrogen, and the measurement from muonic hydrogen represented by the tiny dot and tiny band. Okay, and it's the most mundane resolution of this problem would be a greater than 5 sigma shift in the Rydberg constant. And in that sense, it is important to find out what's going on. And various other statements have been made about the importance in contrast with, or in comparison to the muon G minus 2 problem, we can do some sigma-ology. The statistical significance is probably larger here. The UV completion plausibility very likely is much better here. And in each case, there are two difficult hadronic effects, a large effect, the hadronic polarization, or the leading charge radius contribution, and a small but difficult to calculate effect, the light by light, or the two photon exchange. And there's a real industry of model building for two photon exchange in G minus two, and there's now a somewhat of a ramp up of interest in nailing down the hadronic uncertainties in muonic hydrogen and related systems. All right, so there are many contributions to muonic hydrogen. There are multiple scales in the problem, but the formalism I'm talking about is most relevant for the description of proton structure represented by four entries in this very large table. All right, so why don't I give you a very brief preview of the slides, or I don't know if you want me to just to keep talking.
How about we try to wrap up in 5 minutes, and then whoever is interested can stay and ask more questions about the form.
That sounds good. Okay, so the options are the obvious ones to resolve this problem. If it is not an experimental issue for which there has been no plausible indication, then it is either the case that both electronic hydrogen measurements and electron scattering measurements are wrong, and this was would be the resulting greater than 5 sigma shift in the Rydberg. It would also imply related issues in other processes, such as neutrino nucleon scattering measurements, important for neutrino oscillations.
Let's say that the experiments have a systematic error that measures the proton charge and the scattering experiment. Would that be by changing it to a different value of the proton value? Would it be enough to get in agreement the hydrogen and the muonic hydrogen?
No, you have to change the hydrogen and the electron scattering, both.
For hydrogen, it's something like 6 sigma, for electron scattering, something like
I'll give a table at the end with some of the sigmaology, but it's, I mean, it's significant. And one would have to throw out a lot of things. It could be a new structure effect in muonic hydrogen. I mean, I have to say that, you know, even though this is rather dramatic, it may be the most plausible one. A loophole is that there is a difficult to calculate effect due to two-photon exchange in muonic hydrogen. It's not easy to see how that would be large enough to get close to the central value, but it is analogous to the light by like G minus two. It leaves an uneasy feeling. Potentially, it is accessible in future muon proton scattering or other experiments. Okay, so I'll just say that this, NRQED canon should be extended to describe more complicated nuclei and replacing more traditional analyses that assume a known charge distribution of a loosely bound nuclear system and a framework within which one can calculate corrections in a zero recoil expansion. You can show that this involves expanding in the analog of m rho over m proton, which is not a good expansion for the proton. It could be a reasonable expansion for other larger nuclei. In terms of NRQED, there are two relevant interactions. There's the charge radius term denoted CD. It's a del dot E interaction in NRQED. It's related to the slope of the electric form factor and is conventionally defined as the charge radius squared in some units. And the danger signs is that we have to make sure that we're using the same definition and comparing to hydrogen data. We have to subtract off two photon exchange in the scattering measurement to isolate what we call CD. And we need to extrapolate the scattering measurements performed at non-zero Q squared to obtain the slope, which defines the radius itself. Okay, so one can draw diagrams in NRQED and compute radiative corrections and hence define what we mean by CD in the presence of radiative corrections. This is just an illustration for potential scattering. Two-photon exchange. Okay, so the effects of proton structure in this blob are encapsulated in the NRQED interactions in addition to a contact interaction representing the hard momentum region of this one-loop diagram. And it's the D1 coefficient that gives rise to a contribution to the spin-independent Lamb shift. Okay, so if we want to do this matching calculation, this full theory diagram for electron-proton goes to electron-proton, or muon-proton goes to muon-proton, we can do that calculation as a forward scattering. We can match at any convenient point. If we choose the forward point, then everything that we need to know is given by a forward scattering of an off-shell photon on a proton. Okay, we can analyze in the small lepton mass limit. Unfortunately, that's not good enough for muonic hydrogen. Muon mass is not small compared to the pion mass or the delta proton mass splitting. This gives you a scale of some of the numbers in the small lepton mass limit. There is 100 plus dot, 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 100 log ml. What we would need in this expansion is roughly a C of order 1,000. That would give us an order one contribution to the anomaly. 1,000 is not as big as it seems since we're using bad units. It should be in units of the excitation energy m pi as opposed to the
the proton mass. So, you know, 100 is a more reasonable estimate of the canonical scale, but still we would need something on the order of 10 times as big as that power counting would suggest. If we knew everything about the forward Compton amplitude, we'd know everything we need to know to compute the full theory side of this matching computation. If we knew everything about the imaginary parts of the forward Compton amplitude form factors or structure functions, and if these guys satisfied unsubtracted dispersion relations, then we could reconstruct the full functions. Unfortunately, one of them, the W1 structure function, does not satisfy an unsubtracted dispersion relation. You can see this, for example, because its low energy expansion is a negative number and cannot be written as a dispersion integral over positive partial cross sections. Okay, so we're left with an unconstrained, to start off with, function plus an integral over imaginary parts that are related to partial cross sections. We can do some analysis at low Q squared in our QED, at high Q squared in an OPE to get some idea. This is just a description of what was done previously in the original muonic hydrogen extraction to estimate this function. There's an artificial separation into what are called proton parts and non-proton parts. I don't think I'll go into the details of this ansatz, but just illustrate that using the same ansatz in the spin-dependent case where we actually know the answer because there is an unsubtract dispersion relation, we find a sharp disagreement between the ansatz and the actual data. So it's just a warning to be careful. And I'll leave you with the words that we said some time ago. Those are the words that we said. And I think it is also true that it's not easy to find significantly more with reasonable modeling of this function, but it's an unsatisfactory state of affairs. Finding a larger contribution that brings you closer to the central value of muonic hydrogen. Okay, so one can analyze various limits with NRQED, and those are interesting, but let me, skip to the chase. So there are a few changes to the original muonic hydrogen. There was a mismatch in definitions of the charge radius that led to a small shift. And there was a mismatch in conventions used to model two-photon exchange, and the difference of the two calculations that were quoted in the original muonic hydrogen analysis, the difference of those two is actually a few times the quoted error bar. It's still small compared to the discrepancy. The two-photon exchange can be divided into continuum parts determined by inelastic scattering by a proton contribution defined conventionally in terms of elastic proton form factors and a model-dependent part. And in these models, the model-dependent part is the largest part, leaving some uneasy feeling about it. All right, and that's the end. This is the sigmology, which has not changed significantly in the past year. The first column here is giving the values as of the original publication. The second giving the modifications if we fix up some of the discrepancies in conventions, assign a larger contribution, just assume 100% uncertainty on the two photon exchange, and get rid of a double counting issue here. So the old codata discrepancy was 4.2 sigma. The new discrepancy, 7 sigma, including both hydrogen and electron proton. And these discrepancies are decreased somewhat by increasing this uncertainty, although they're still significant. And if we're more conservative, actually, we're just doing a model independent analysis of the scattering, which I'm not describing here. But if one does a more robust analysis of the extrapolation to Q squared equals to zero, then one arrives at larger error bars, and one can do a bit better by including also neutron scattering data and PiPi to NN bar data to account for to constrain the shape in the ISO vector channel. And the uncertainties here are somewhat larger, but still leave a significant discrepancy with the muonic hydrogen measurement. So that's approximately the present status. And with that, I will conclude and I think leave you with my conclusions. Thanks.
Okay, so given we've moved it over already, why don't we just have the speaker again, and anyone wants to chat more can help you measure, unless there's something with you. Okay. So, thank you, Richard.
Thank you.